go ahead and turn to the book of Micah, chapter 5. I've referred to Micah at various times, but this is the first time that I've ever taught a passage with that being the focus. Very interesting passage here, of course. We have three outline points. The coming Messiah is going to be chapter 5, verses 2 through 5a. The reigning Messiah in verses 5b through 15. And then we're doing a version of who's on first. This is going to be where's on first. And for that, we will be looking at New Testament passages. So, let's begin. Of course, Micah 5:2 is a famous passage. It is quoted in the New Testament and is an important prophecy concerning the coming of the Messiah. But this passage is going to move beyond the first coming into the second coming. But let's take a look here at the beginning. The coming Messiah, verses 2 through 5a. Now, we have a town in New Mexico that up until March of 1950 was known as Hot Springs. But they took advantage of an opportunity to rename themselves after the then radio program Truth or Consequences. That later on became a television game show. But as a result of renaming themselves, they gained some notoriety and they ended up hosting the radio program one time in 1950. So it's an instance of a place that had a name change. This is going to be useful.
Sorry.
This is going to be useful here as we look at our passage because it says, but you, Bethlehem, are Ephrathah. Well, notice that it says, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. As we look at Joshua chapter 15 and Nehemiah chapter 11, there are 123 listed Judean cities and towns. So on the map, the area that's inside the red circle, that's there in sort of a reddish color, is the approximate area of the country of Judah in the Old Testament. In that area, we find 123 listed Judean cities and towns. But Bethlehem is not named as one of them. The first time that Bethlehem shows up in the Bible is here in Micah. And so it is an indication of how small the place was. It was regarded as insignificant, so only a very short distance, about 6 miles away from Jerusalem, but fairly insignificant in Old Testament times. Now, under other names it does show up. It is where Rachel died, and there it was referred to as Ramah, but it underwent a name change, another name change. So at one point it seems to have been called Ephrathah. We have a passage in Genesis, which is where Rachel's death is mentioned, that it says that it had an older name, but was then Bethlehem. Now, why would it be relatively small historically? Bethlehem is right on the edge of the wilderness. It's not in the wilderness, but you just go a little east of it, and it's barren, supports nothing. And so it's really on the edge. And so as a result of that, it just never took on great significance. It was on a major roadway going down to Beersheba and so on and so forth. People would pass through it, but that was its main claim to fame until you have David coming out of that line and then being made king. Now, I have an interesting thing here where it is speaking with regard to this coming one, the one who is going to be ruler in Israel, coming from a fairly insignificant place, coming from Bethlehem, says his goings forth are from old, from everlasting. This is a hint that we're not just looking at an ordinary human ruler. The Messiah, there are indications within the Old Testament that he was going to be God. Remember in Isaiah, and Isaiah is contemporary with Micah, spoke in chapter 7, verse 14, about the prophecy of Emmanuel, who would be born of a virgin. Well, Emmanuel means God with us. Various indications in the Old Testament that this coming one is going to be God. Now, obviously, the people in the Old Testament didn't necessarily know quite what to do with some of the details. But as we get into the New Testament, we get clarifications. But notice, from everlasting. His goings are from old, from everlasting. As we look in the Old Testament, we see God interacting with men, starting with creation, going on through the early chapters of Genesis, and then with the call of Abraham and various appearances to the patriarchs, and God intervening there to bring about the Exodus and to provide for the people as they were in the wilderness, and then to enable them to enter into the promised land under Joshua and to have great victories as they spent 7 years conquering the land. The member of the Trinity that we see, the one that had the interactions with humanity, is Jesus Christ. John chapter 1 makes it very clear that Jesus was the creator. We would speak of theophanies, that is, appearances of God, but those appearances of God in Old Testament times were appearances of Christ. When it speaks of his goings forth are from old, from everlasting, this is looking at God's interaction with humanity, specifically the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ interacting with humanity. His goings forth are from old, from everlasting. But then it's a surprise. Here we get to verse 3. Therefore, he shall give them up. This appears on the arch dedicated to Titus in Rome. Titus was the one that led the siege of Jerusalem, and he later became emperor of the Roman Empire. And so this is depicting the pillaging of the temple there in 70 AD. And so, under the terms of the land covenant, Deuteronomy chapters 28 through 30, when Israel would rebel against God in terms of violating the land covenant. The most severe form of discipline is that they would be exiled. And the nation of Judah, at the time that Isaiah and the time that Micah was writing, were in a very sad plight, and they were running away from the Lord, and they were approaching that day when, in 586, the Babylonians would take over Jerusalem and deport vast swaths of the populace. But therefore he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth. Many people, as they look at this passage, want to refer this to Mary and want to refer it to the virgin birth. But it seems instead that what we're looking at is until the second coming, that the birth is going to be the birth of the nation, the rebirth of the nation under the Messiah, the restoration of the kingdom that the disciples asked Jesus in Acts chapter 1, verse 6. Is it at this time that you are restoring the kingdom to Israel? Is being pictured in terms of labor and birth because of the tremendous anguish that the nation would face through the conquest, through the occupation by foreigners, all the things that would go on between 586 BC and when finally, in the future, Jesus establishes the millennial kingdom. And so the giving up of the nation is a temporary thing. It was not a permanent abandonment, but it was a setting them aside because of their rebellion against the land covenant. And everything is being done in terms of prophecies in Daniel chapter 9 to prepare the nation for them to receive their Messiah. They were not ready during the interval. They were not ready when he came, but they will receive him. There will be national belief. There will also be national repentance at the time of the second coming. God is doing things to prepare the nation. And it's being viewed from the standpoint of labor and birth. Let's look at this temporary setting aside. It's a very interesting thing here as we look at how much of the time have Jewish people ruled over Jerusalem? How much of time is it since the Babylonian captivity that Israel has been ruled by Jews? And as you look there on the chart, what we have is almost the entire period of time they're ruled by foreigners. And so I have the number of years off on the side, but you know, Babylon and Persia, Alexander, that is the Greeks, then you have the Ptolemies, who were the Greeks down in Egypt, then the Seleucids, the Greeks in Syria. Then finally, from 167 BC to 63 BC, there was independence after the Maccabean revolt. You may remember the Feast of Hanukkah, which, by the way, John chapter 10, Jesus observed Hanukkah, and that passage, that was a celebration of the rededication of the temple after it had been desecrated by the Seleucid Greeks. Then Rome, and then after the split of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine portion of the Roman Empire ruled until 614. Then Persia. Then four dynasties of Muslims, first from Damascus, then from Baghdad, then from Cairo, and again from Baghdad. Then the Crusaders were in there and took over. Then there were two more dynasties of Muslims, first from Damascus and then from Cairo. Then the nation of Turkey ruled over it until 1917. Then Great Britain took possession until the formation of the modern state of Israel. And that's now been 75 years. Out of all of this time, it has been 179 years so far of Jewish self-rule and 2,430 years of foreign domination. That is what is meant here about he shall give them up, verse 3. Now we don't know when the rapture is going to occur, and we don't know when the second coming 7 years after the approximately 7 years after the rapture will occur. We don't know the dates of that. I mean, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24 that no one knows. It's a date that is a complete secret. It will not be known the date of the rapture until it has happened. So, Israel will probably have more than the 75 years here that they continue to possess the land. There will be that period of time during the tribulation under which they are under a treaty that they have signed. So it's still going to be a relatively low portion of that time. Between the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC and the time of the rapture and then the second coming, that Jews will be ruling themselves in Israel. That's the context of he shall give them up. And so all of this time is being depicted as a time of labor awaiting childbirth and the joy of the pain being gone and of the child being born, shall we speak, shall we say. But from a human standpoint, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again after he fell off the wall. It's an interesting thing that prior to 1948, non-dispensational writers made fun of the idea that dispensationalists believed that Israel would be restored as a nation. That's just something that no one would expect except by believing biblical prophecies about that. Until 1948, dispensationalists were ridiculed for that. I remember reading Oswald T. Ellis, and he said, well, he found something favorable to say about dispensationalists. This was well before 1948. He said, well, they at least believe the Bible, or at least the portion of the Bible that's talking about Israel being restored, although they don't understand it, and Israel will not be restored. So he made a backhanded attack on dispensationalists at the time that he praised them for believing at least a portion of the Bible. Interesting thing here. Let's make a comparison here, though. You know, all hope had absolutely died for Israel being restored, except that God promised it. But then you have Ezekiel 37. That's the passage about the dry bones. The Old Testament does speak of there being two regatherings of Israel, a partial one in unbelief. That's what happened starting in 1948. And then there will be a complete one led by the Messiah. And Ezekiel 37 focuses upon that yet future complete regathering in belief by the Messiah. But let's look at an illustration of a nation that had been divided and had fallen, and you know, one wouldn't expect, you know, after the Berlin Wall went up in August of 1961, one wouldn't expect that just a little over 10,000 days later, in 1989, that Germany would be reunited. But how much greater a miracle it is for a small nation, the nation of Israel, who during all of these years of exile maintained a national identity and had a period of time outside of the land that amounts to 100 times the length of time that the Berlin Wall was up. I mean, instead of having 10,000 days outside of the land, Israel had a little over 1 million days outside of the land. But God promised they would be regathered. And it would be regathered in two stages. It is a far greater miracle that Israel and Judah could be rejoined and the nation could come back into existence. That's a far greater miracle than Germany being split up into four sectors, which became two parts, West and East Germany. Then after, as the Soviet Union was collapsing, for it to become reunited. It's only 1% of the number of days to have 10,000 days of separation for East and West Germany, 1 million plus days for Israel to be not only split, but not in control of their own land. But then, the remnant of his brethren shall return to the children of Israel. The call of the shofar. Jesus is going to ultimately regather the entirety of the Jewish populace, that is, Jewish believers, into the land as he establishes the millennial kingdom. The partial regathering in unbelief has already happened. And he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall abide, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. Jesus is going to be ruler over planet Earth, and he is going to regather the flock of Israel. Interesting thing in the Gospel of John. Hold your place in Micah and turn to John chapter 10. In John 10, Jesus has spoken of himself as the Good Shepherd. You'll notice as you look at verse 6 in John 10, that Jesus told the story a first time. He used this illustration, but they did not understand the things which he spoke to them. Okay, let's look at what he spoke to them. Starting at 10:1. Amen, amen, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper or gatekeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he brings out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know the voice. They know his voice, yet they will by no means follow a stranger, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. Now, who is it that Jesus is saying this to? Well, if you have a red letter Bible, it'll be rather easy to notice that the last verse in John 9 has Jesus speaking. And you go into chapter 10, verse 1, he's still speaking. Now, the way we have our chapter break, and you might have titles in your Bible, you know, in my Bible, here it says 9:35, the true vision and true blindness, going between verses 35 and 41. Then chapter 10, verses 1 through 6, Jesus the true shepherd. Chapters 10, verse 7, Jesus the Good Shepherd. Well, we're inclined to think of it, well, chapter break, this is a complete division, but wait a moment, there's some interesting things here. When John's Gospel says, amen, amen, or as the New King James translates it, most assuredly, or you might have verily, verily, or you have a variety of things at the beginning of 10:1, those types of statements do not appear at the beginning of a speech. They are where Jesus has, he wants to draw the listeners to understand a concluding point. That's an indication that he is speaking starting in verse 41, and there he's talking to people who were aware of Jesus healing the man who had been blind from birth, and these Pharisees then said in verse 40, are we blind also? What Jesus did was he said, well, if you were blind, you would have no sin. That is, you wouldn't have culpability for having kicked out an innocent man out of your synagogue. He's not saying that they're not sinners. He's saying you wouldn't have culpability. The way that John uses this phrase, not to have sin, whether in the Gospel of John, I believe it appears three times, then we also have it in 1 John. Each one of those times he's talking about culpability or guilt. So he has said you are guilty. And the fact that you recognize what you recognize seals that you are culpable for having kicked this man out of the synagogue. I'll talk about that a little later. To tie that together. But here's what he does. He tells a story, and in this story there is a legitimate shepherd, but then there are ones that have climbed over the wall and they've rustled sheep. Jesus is presenting it from the standpoint that the Pharisees really are not the legitimate shepherds that were appointed by God, but they have wrestled their way into their position. And so then he illustrates that his sheep are smart enough to run away from the voice they don't recognize. And lo and behold, that's exactly what this blind man has done. Now, I want to show that they knew that Jesus had done a sign, that Jesus had done something truly miraculous. Back up to, Jesus healed a man who had been born blind on the Sabbath. Notice what it says in chapter 9, verse 18. But the Judeans, these Pharisees, did not believe concerning him, that is the blind man, that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. They interrogated the parents, and the parents stood up to the interrogation. They were not able to tear holes in their stories. They were not able to show that they had contrived a lie. It says that until they had done that, they didn't believe that this man had formerly been blind. At this point, they now recognize, yes, this man had been blind, now he sees. You go back earlier, and the fact that Jesus did the healing on the Sabbath makes it so that they regard him as public enemy number one. But notice, they're recognizing that he has done what would be a sign, a proof that he's Messiah. They have rejected him, but they can't deny the miracle. They know that the formerly blind man has spoken the truth. But we have another very interesting thing that happens in this passage. Let's look at the parents, and what we're going to see is the parents didn't tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. They left out some of the truth because they knew that the leaders had already determined that anyone who confessed Jesus as the Christ would be excommunicated. They didn't want that to happen. So they didn't say that they knew who had healed their son. Okay, verse 20. His parents answered them and said, "We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. So far they're telling the truth. Now they lie. But by what means he now sees, we do not know. Second lie. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know." Then they throw him under the bus. "He is of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Judeans, for the Judeans had already agreed that if anyone confessed that he was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." All of this indicates that despite the fact that the Pharisees have no good answer for how it is that Jesus is able to heal this man, when this man speaks the truth that Jesus healed him, they excommunicate him. That is the basis for what Jesus is saying here now. In this story that he tells, he's talking about how they, as legalists, end up persecuting those that are under them, like the former blind man. Now we see in verse 6, Jesus used this illustration, but they didn't understand the things which he spoke to them, so he told it to them again in an expanded form. In this expanded form, Jesus makes an interesting statement in John 10:16. That's what we're looking at here with this slide. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold. He's not talking about Gentiles. This is where most people go. They say, well, this is Jesus anticipating the inclusion of Gentiles. There's a major problem with that, and that's verse 10:16b. Them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. But Ephesians chapter 3 tells us that it was not Jesus who revealed the mystery of Jews and Gentiles being united into one body, but it was the apostles after Cornelius, Acts chapter 10. They revealed it to the church. It was not revealed. The mystery was not revealed at all prior to that. Jesus is not, therefore, talking about Gentiles. So, who are these people? He's saying, he's now in Jerusalem, so he's in Judah. And he says, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. They're part of another fold. That other fold is Galilee. And he's talking about there's going to be a reunification so that there will be one flock, one shepherd. Lo and behold, he's talking about some of the things that Micah is pointing to. Micah is writing as the northern kingdom is ready to be decimated and made to go into exile under the Assyrians. And the Assyrians are then going to put pressure on Judah as well. All of this is going to transpire, and yet the nation is going to be ultimately regathered under the Messiah. That's what Jesus is talking about here in John 16 as well. This one shall be peace. And this is the Hebrew word shalom, meaning peace. The peace is going to be so complete that Israel itself is going to be able to disarm. Jesus will maintain firm power, so they're going to be able to disarm. They can't do that right now. They live in kind of a rough neighborhood, and they can't do that. All you have to do is look at your news and see what's going on in Israel at this time. I can see that I've actually divided my outline. I put the heading at the wrong point. It was supposed to go above 5b, not below it. But Diane, you could change that when we print this out. So, the coming Messiah is predicted, and he's going to be arising out of what was a fairly insignificant place. Not mentioned within the 123 cities and towns of Jerusalem, of Judah, in those passages that are listing cities and towns of Judah. Bethlehem is mentioned here and there, but it was a relatively insignificant place, so it didn't make it into the top 123 places. It wasn't regarded as the place to be from. But now we're going to look at the reigning Messiah. We're going to see him take power and then to solidify his administration. So looking at Second Coming and Millennial Kingdom. So the reigning Messiah, 5:5b through 15. When the Assyrian comes into our land, and when he treads in our palaces, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princely men. The Assyrian, here is the king of the north, often mistakenly called the Antichrist. Antichrist should be associated with the false prophet rather than the king of the north. The king of the north is here referred to as the Assyrian. Now, you have probably heard that there's going to be a reconstituted Roman Empire and so forth with a League of Ten Nations and so on and so forth. All of that works out, but it is probably not coming together quite in the way that people have often thought of it. I would take it that this, the king that's going to be, the beast that's going to be running rampant during the tribulation, actually will be an Assyrian, but at the same time, in a sense, he will also be Roman. Because the Roman Empire conquered as far east as Assyria. And a portion of Assyria, I mean, the Assyrian Empire ended up occupying a far larger area than what became the province of Assyria, but Assyria, a person can be Assyrian and be Roman because Assyria is within the area that was conquered by the Roman Empire. It gives room for this figure to be of Assyrian birth, but still to be Roman. I think that that's a way to take seriously some of the texts and to put them together in the proper way. There is a small surviving populace. There's an ethnic group, a small group of Assyrians. It is an ethnic group that exists to this day. They've received a lot of persecution by the countries of Syria, Turkey, and Iraq. But it is an ethnic group that exists, and that man is going to come out of it. You can see the area where ethnic Assyrians live up in the upper left of this. Now, talks about him treading in their palaces. This is an archaeological dig in Jerusalem. This seems to be as a result of its position of height with all sorts of fortifications around it, and the fact that official seals have been found and so forth to have been David's palace. You may remember in 2 Samuel 7 when David had built his palace and it was, shall we say, palatial. He noted that the tabernacle was just a tent and he wanted to build a temple, and God told him, well, you're a man of war. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You are not the one who's going to build the temple. It wasn't saying that being a man of war was a bad thing, but it was saying that's what he needed to do. He needed to make it so that there would be a time of peace so that his son could build the temple. But the Assyrian is going to come in and he's going to take over. And there's going to be a lot of things that are going to go very badly, especially after the treaty is broken in the middle half of the tribulation and so on and so forth. When it's talking about him treading in the palace, it's saying he's in charge. He's taken power. But what is going to happen? God's going to raise up 7 shepherds and 8 princely men. God is going to raise up ones who are going to stand in the gap and be part of this process there that the Lord is going to use at his second coming in order to restore things as they ought to be. So in verse 6, they shall waste with a sword the land of Assyria and the land of Nimrod at its entrances. Then thus he shall deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and when he treads within our borders. Battle of Armageddon, so on and so forth, all of this is in view. And actually, it's not the Battle of Armageddon so much as Armageddon is a perfect staging area, but it's the ultimate destination isn't Megiddo. The destination is Jerusalem. Jesus warns of the armies surrounding Jerusalem, of their staging area prior to going to attack Jerusalem is there at Megiddo. But here we have once again that Roman province of Assyria. And so he is going to be bringing might to bear upon Israel. There are going to be lots of problems that are going to develop during that time. It's going to be an awful period of time, the Great Tribulation. But notice, he, and this is talking about that one who traces back to Bethlehem, is looking at Jesus, looking at him, second coming. He shall deliver us from the Assyrian. It's not we will deliver ourselves from the Assyrian, but it is he shall deliver us from the Assyrian. When he comes into our land, when he, the Assyrian, comes into our land, and when he, the Assyrian, treads within our borders. We're going to see a contrast that's going to be like night, day and night between verse 7 and verse 8. Verse 7 is looking very positively once the millennial kingdom has been established, but verse 8 is looking at any rebels within the ranks and how they're going to be dealt with. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples like the dew from the Lord. Micah chapter 5, verse 7a. On the inset map, I've shown Greater Israel. That is using the boundaries that are given to us in Genesis chapter 15. That was the land that was promised to Abraham. Israel has never owned that area. And actually, the demarcation that the people who drew that have is not necessarily the full extent, because there is no eastern border. That is, there is no border saying how large or how small Saudi Arabia will be. Now, I did have to improvise on this map a little bit. If you look closely, you'll notice that Egypt is slightly darker than any of the other places. I've had to change what they had because the people that drew up this map understood Greater Israel during the millennium as extending to the Nile River. That's incorrect. The boundary that's given in Genesis 15 is to Wadi El Arish, which is approximately where the border is currently between Israel and Egypt. God did not promise Israel that it would own the east bank of the Nile River and that. So I corrected the map and that in order to fit it in here. But Greater Israel is looking at the boundaries that were promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. What's it talking about here, like dew from the Lord? There's going to be refreshment, there's going to be moisture, the ability to grow crops, the ability to do other things that come from moisture. But who is responsible for it? The Lord. It's not coming from the source of Israel. Remember, it said earlier, He will deliver us from the Assyrian. And as God places Israel there within the boundaries that He promised back in Genesis 15, when He does that during the millennium, Israel is going to be the blessing to all the nations of the world that it was intended to be. Genesis chapter 12, verse 3 commanded Abram to be a blessing. Unfortunately, most English translations do not translate the imperative there as an imperative. They treat it as a prophecy. You will be a blessing. Well, they will be. But actually, what was said in Genesis 12, verse 3 was, be a blessing. But then he announced, those who bless you, I will bless, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, that is in your lineage, all families of the earth will be blessed. This passage, Micah 5, 7, is looking at Israel being placed in such a way during the millennium that it will in fact be a blessing to the nations that surround it. Notice the remnant of Jacob talking about the remnant of believing Israel shall be in the midst of many peoples. And so it's going to be surrounded by other nations, but there will be peace, as was promised in chapter 5, verse 5a, because the Lord is the one who is guaranteeing the peace. And then, like the showers on the grass that tarry for no man, nor wait for the sons of men. Clearly, it's on God's timetable. That's the reason for the clock up there. But God sets up the timetable, and man is not responsible for it raining or not raining. God is the one that is responsible for the bringing of blessing. Now, remember I said it's going to be like day and night between verse 7 and verse 8. The structure of the two passages is parallel, but they are antithetical to one another. That verse 7 is looking at blessing coming to Gentiles from the Messiah in regard to Israel in relation to other nations in the millennium. And then verse 8 is going to look at where the Lord needs to step in. And here, it's going to be done with might. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, who, if he passes through, both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. If the sheep here are being, I mean, it's not a friendly situation here with the sheep. The sheep are being pictured here as the foreign nations, but I've figured you'd prefer a picture like this rather than gory, but you can use your imagination here. If he passes through, he both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. Why can't they deliver? It's because it's the Lord's doing. Is not mere man and mere mortal armies. It's the Lord who's in charge. Those who line up with his plan are going to have experienced the blessing of the Lord during the millennium. But there is going to be that rod of iron that he's going to rule with that we're told about in other passages. And so rebellion is going to be dealt with swiftly. Israel is going to be put in a commanding position by the Lord. Your hand shall be lifted against your adversaries, and all your enemies will be cut off. They're not going to be in a position where their security is as easily disturbed as it is now. Everything's going to be different, because the Lord is going to be the one that's going to guarantee his covenant. It shall be in that day that I will cut off your horses from your midst and destroy your chariots. The Lord is going to disarm Israel. And it's not so that they can be plundered and conquered by others. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 16 warned that it would be that when kings came into the land, that they would be multiplying horses and so on and so forth and chariots in order to make themselves powerful, and they would depend upon that. Jesus is going to be the one that is going to guarantee the security of Israel during the millennium. And so they will be able to disarm, and they will be disarmed by the Lord, because he is the one that is going to guarantee their security. He's going to be the one that's going to rule with a rod of iron. What is the situation in Micah's day? It's the same situation that happened in Isaiah's day. Israel, or actually Judah, was trying to make alliances with other nations, and it was trying to build up its army as its defense, without realizing that ultimately it needed to depend upon the Lord, and it couldn't be operating in violation of the commands given through the prophets that they were not to enter into the alliances with the other countries for their security. The security would come from obeying what the prophets had said. And the removal of that which they would depend upon is so that during the millennium, their focus will be the Lord is the one who is guaranteeing our security. I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. They're not going to be in a position where they're going to be able to elevate in their thinking their own defenses, because it is the Lord who delivered them from the Assyrian. It is the Lord who is going to make them a blessing among the nations that are surrounding them. It is the Lord who is going to protect the covenant, not they themselves. All of this is picturing it's going to be done ultimately by the Lord. He wants them to realize he is the one doing this. The Lord is the one came as a Messiah, as one born in Bethlehem of a virgin. And everything is depicting it is God who is doing this. I will cut off your sorceries from your hand. You shall have no soothsayers. Your carved images I will also cut off, and your sacred pillars from your midst. You will no more worship the work of your hands. I will pluck your wooden images from your midst. All of their dependencies that have taken them away from the Lord, that have caused them to say, well, God won't deliver us, but this God or goddess will. This idol will deliver us. My chariots will deliver me. My alliances will deliver me. If all of that was false dependencies. But in the millennial kingdom, the Lord is going to directly guarantee their security and their prosperity, and he will have removed things from them. They're not going to have walled cities. The place is going to be under security granted by the Lord. So, I will destroy your cities. They've got walled cities, and the word city is often used to differentiate whether there is a wall or is not a wall, and so forth. So the terminology is rather interesting, and so broad strokes, there were places that were walled and there were ones that were not walled, and so on and so forth. The walls are the thing that is the focus here. Anything that is going to cause them to depend upon themselves or some false god, that's going to be removed, and they're going to be focused upon the Lord himself. But there still are going to be those occasions when the Lord is going to have to rule with the rod of iron. And I will execute vengeance in anger and fury on the nations that have not heeded. There are going to be nations that are going to say, well, you know, we don't like all of this, and they're going to rise up and do this and that, especially at the end of the millennium, the rebellion that will occur there. But anything is going to be dealt with swiftly. And so we have seen the coming Messiah. He come from Bethlehem, but it's the Lord himself, someone whose goings forth have been from of old, even from eternity. And he's going to reign with grace and with swift justice. Now we're going to do a little turn on who's on first. But it's where's on first? What's going on here? Bethlehem has been rather important here in the background, because that is where the Messiah comes from. And so the one born in Bethlehem, the one born where David was born, the second king of the nation, to whom God gave the Davidic covenant, promising an everlasting dynasty, that makes Bethlehem rather significant. And so I'm focusing upon Bethlehem, not so much the coming of the Messiah and the reigning of the Messiah, but now we're going to look at Bethlehem, because in John's Gospel it is a little surprising how Bethlehem is and is not handled. And the question arises in John's Gospel, why doesn't John's Gospel say Jesus is a Galilean resident who was born in Bethlehem? You know, many times in John's Gospel it said, well, he's Galilean. And people say, well, you know, if he's Galilean, he can't be the Messiah. And one would think, at first glance, that John would say, well, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. He meets the qualification of Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Interestingly, the only time that Micah 5, 2 is alluded to in the entire book of John is by people who try to use it as an argument that Jesus isn't legitimate because he lives in Galilee. So what I really am wanting to do here in this analysis as we move forward is to explain why it is that John doesn't just say, well, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Why is it that John wouldn't use such an obvious argument? Why is it that he handles this differently than we might expect? So instead of who's on first, where's on first? That is, where is Jesus from first? Obviously not Galilee. Galilee is later. It's not first. But is Bethlehem first? Not according to Jesus, and not according to John. It would be second, not first. And so, first is going to be somewhere other than Bethlehem. Second will be Bethlehem. Third is Galilee. Okay, we are obviously familiar with the passages that tell us that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Matthew 2:1, Luke 2:4, 2:15. You will notice that Matthew 2:1 is the only passage that I have included here from Matthew 2. The other passages in Matthew 2, when the Magi came, are not right at his birth, but they are subsequently after Joseph and Mary had actually moved into a house. So contrary to the manger scenes that show shepherds and wise men at the same time by the manger, the Magi did not see the manger. And that's so wanted to find a picture where it wasn't hard to exclude the Magi from this scene. So now the question comes up of, okay, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, born in a manger, because there was no room at the inn, and so on and so forth. But when the Magi came looking for him, the star had appeared at Jesus' birth, and they followed it. My operating assumption, I cannot prove it, but my operating assumption is that the Magi may well have been exiled Jews, exiled Judeans in Babylon, who were familiar with Old Testament passages. I believe that they were Judean. I don't believe that they were Gentiles. And so they're coming to worship the one who is king over the Judeans. I'm going to explain something that has puzzled people, and that is, why is it that they don't go directly to Bethlehem? Why is it that they go to Jerusalem? We're not told whether the star was, which I think was a theophany rather than a physical star, Whether it was shining continually, it doesn't appear to have been so as they headed to Jerusalem, but even if they knew, which they may well have known, that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem, they would have had no idea, they wouldn't expect that he would have continued to stay there. The natural assumption would be, well, if he's king, wouldn't he move 6 miles from Bethlehem to Jerusalem? So they went to Jerusalem looking for him, apparently not being guided by the heavenly appearance of the Shekinah in order to lead them at that point. After they had the interview with Herod, then the star seems to have reappeared, and it was directly over the house, and they went there. But we're told that they went to a house. They did not go to the stable. Okay, so now, specifically the rest of the passages, we're looking at John. Why doesn't John ever say, well, Jesus is a resident of Galilee, but he was born in Judea, specifically he was born in Bethlehem? Well, here we have a golden opportunity for that to be said. If you turn to John chapter 1, we have Philip leading Nathanael to Jesus. And so in verse 45, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Now, he's the son of Joseph by adoption, not by physical birth. It was virgin birth, as the text makes very clear. But he brought up Nazareth, apparently because there were a lot of people with the name Yeshua. And that was a red flag to Philip. Philip is figuring, well, you know, can any good come out of Nazareth? This is often treated as though he's saying, oh, Galilee, that's a backwater. John 21, we find that Nathanael was from Bethsaida, and so, which is in Galilee, and so a town just down the road from Nazareth, and so forth. Well, what has happened is there was a red herring that was brought out here. That would have been a time where John could have said, well, actually, he was born in Bethlehem, but he didn't. Just left hanging. No explanation. Let's go to John chapter 7. In John chapter 7, I believe that this passage should be punctuated as a question. Greek does not use word order as English does to differentiate statements from questions. And the wording of the verse yields easily a question. But within the context, it becomes evident that Jesus is saying that they don't know where he is from. Let's start at verse 25. Some of them from Jerusalem said, "Is this not he whom they seek to kill? But look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? However, we know where this man is from. But when the Christ comes, no one knows where he is from." Okay, so they've claimed to know where he's from, and they're operating under the assumption that, well, the Messiah is going to be mysterious. Don't know how they would integrate Bethlehem into this, but Bethlehem will come up later in this context. Then Jesus cried out and taught in the temple, saying, New King James says, "You both know me, and you know where I am from? Now, I render that as a question. Also, do you know me? And do you know where I am from? Where's he from? I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. Is he not saying, I was sent from heaven by my Father? Is not Jesus saying that first is heaven? First is from God. The issue in John's gospel isn't to say, oh, Jesus is from Bethlehem. No, John's gospel is saying Jesus is from heaven. The apostle knew that he was born in Bethlehem. But that's not the big issue. The big issue isn't where was Jesus born. It is what is his origin. He's from heaven. This issue keeps boiling in this same chapter. Drop down 751. Some said, will the Christ come out of Galilee? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem where David was? They're using this to say, oh, Jesus can't be the Messiah. He's from Galilee. He's supposed to be from Bethlehem. Now, it would have been easy for John to say, well, actually, Jesus is from Bethlehem. That's where he was born. That's where he's from. But that's not ultimately where he was from. That's secondarily where he was from. He came from heaven and was made incarnate, received a body. He was born in Bethlehem, but he came first from God. Where's first? First is heaven. Bethlehem is second. The people here think, well, he's from Galilee. And they say, he can't be Messiah. He's from Bethlehem. Can't be Messiah. But they're thinking purely at the human level. They aren't realizing he's sent from God. They've missed the point. And lots of expositors, I believe, have missed the point because it's typically said, well, Jesus is from Bethlehem. That's the solution. The solution is it's from heaven. 8:14. The charge was raised that Jesus had no one backing up his testimony. That Jesus was speaking on his own initiative and didn't have someone backing him up. And what he's saying is, well, the Father bears witness of me. But he starts out by saying, even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going, but you do not know where I come from and where I am going. There's much overlap between the people surrounding Jesus in John chapter 7 as there is in John chapter 8. John chapter 7 occurred the day before John 8, and both of them are at the Feast of Tabernacles in the year 32. And it is Judean leadership that is instigating the attacks here upon Jesus in both chapters. This is a reinforcement that in John chapter 7, verse 28, Jesus was not saying, you know where I'm from. despite the fact that my New King James translates 728, you both know where I am from, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know where I'm from. No, it is, do you know where I am from? They don't know where he's from. And so here in chapter 8, verse 14, he says specifically, you don't know where I am from, because they have dismissed his heavenly origin. Then in 8:23, Jesus said to them, you are from beneath. I am from above. You are of this world. I am not of this world. You have your source down below. My source is from above. You originate from the world. I do not originate from this world. If his origin was Bethlehem, if that's where his true ultimate origin was, he'd have to say, well, Bethlehem's in the world. Jesus is not making the point in John's gospel, I trace back to Bethlehem. It's, I trace back to being with the Father. Where does the gospel of John start? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was in Bethlehem. No. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The argument in John's gospel is that Jesus traces his origin back to the Father as part of the Trinity. Pilate isn't concerned in quite the same way as the religious leaders were, although Luke chapter 22 makes it evident that Pilate was surprised when he found out that Jesus lived in Galilee. He assumed that the king of the Judeans would be himself a Judean, that anyone who would claim to be king of the Judeans would also be Judean. So, as the intrigue develops, and he hears further charges from the religious leaders, and that he came to Jesus, where are you from? He never would have believed it if Jesus had told him. Okay, I didn't turn slides, so I'll show you the pictures. Will the Christ come out of Galilee, showing the Sea of Galilee? Has not the scripture said that it comes from Bethlehem, out of the line of David? You do not know where I come from and where I am going. I turned this famous picture upside down to make it easy to say, you're from beneath, you're from the world, I'm from above. And then Pilate, where are you from? Why doesn't John ever say that Jesus is a Galilean resident, that he was born in Judea, specifically born in Bethlehem? It's because the ultimate point is Jesus has legitimately come from the Father. That point is made repeatedly through the book. I've selected a few passages to make it clear that he traces his origins as being from above. So, we've looked at the coming Messiah, we looked at the reigning Messiah, and then I've noted that although it's important, it's an important feature of messianic prophecy, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. The Gospel of John is not focused upon that. The Gospel of John is instead focused upon his heavenly origin. Matthew makes it very clear. Luke makes it very clear. Jesus was born in Bethlehem. This is in keeping with what Micah chapter 5 verse 2 says. Ironically, in John chapter 7, it was the people who cited Micah 5:2 did it to deny that Jesus was the Messiah. Yes, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, but his true origin is from the Father. So, out of Bethlehem.